Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, we are back at it. The number is 888-914-9149. You can call now. We'd love to get you on the air. An email comes in from Kathleen, listening in St. Ignace, Michigan, 940 a.m. She says, the part in the Apostles' Creed where it says, he suffered, died, and was buried. He descended into hell. On the third day, he ascended into heaven. I think most translations would say he rose again from the dead and ascended into heaven. Let's see. It says, where does it say he descended into hell in the Bible? And why was that? When I was younger, I didn't learn the part that he went to hell. Thank you. Well, Kathleen, this is an artifact of the English language in which we use the word in the creed in English as hell, but it doesn't mean the hell of the damned. It's referring to Sheol, or the underworld. And Jesus talks about this in Luke 16, where he gives the story, the parable of Lazarus and the rich man. Chances are you know this parable, where the rich man dined sumptuously and didn't care about the poor man who was sitting on his front doorstep begging for crumbs and dying of hunger. Well, they both wind up dying, Jesus says, and the wealthy man goes to a place of fiery torment. And the poor man, Lazarus, goes to a place of peace and tranquility with Abraham and the other righteous people of the Old Testament. And what ensues is this conversation in which the rich man who's roasting, he calls out because he can see Lazarus over there with Abraham. And he calls out to him and says, Father Abraham, please send Lazarus over here with some water to cool my tongue because these flames are really burning me up. And Abraham says, no. There is a great chasm fixed between where you are and where we are. You can't cross to us and we can't cross to you. And so he asks him, well, then can you send him to go, you know, visit my brothers and warn my brothers, etc. He says, no, they have Moses and the prophets. If they won't listen to Moses and the prophets, then, you know, basically tough luck. The key, though, to understanding this is that both the rich man and Lazarus were in the same general place, which was Sheol, from the Hebrew, meaning the underworld, or Hades, that's the Greek version, meaning the underworld. So when the creed was written in English a long time ago, the word hell had a broader meaning. It didn't just mean the hell of the damned, where the bad people go, where the devil is. It had to do with just the underworld, both good and bad. So the good people who were with Abraham, they were on their way to heaven. Jesus went down there to rescue them. That's what it means by he went to hell. He went to the underworld and he rescued them and he brought them to eternal life in heaven because the gates of heaven had been closed because of the fall of Adam and Eve. Nobody was in heaven. Nobody could go to heaven because Jesus hadn't yet died on the cross to open the gates of heaven. So you ask, where does this talk about this? Well, one passage that sheds some light on it is in 1 Peter chapter 3, beginning in verse 8. It says, for Christ also suffered for sins once, the righteous for the sake of the unrighteous, that he might lead you to God, put to death in the flesh, he was brought to life in the spirit. In it, he also went to preach to the spirits in prison, who had once been disobedient while God patiently waited in the days of Noah. So there it's referring to those people, those good, righteous people of the Old Testament who were going to go to heaven, but they weren't there yet. He went into the underworld to get them. It says it also in verse 6 of chapter 4, for this is why the gospel was preached even to the dead, that though condemned in the flesh, in human estimation, they might live in the spirit in the estimation of God. So that's an oblique reference to Jesus going there to get them. He did not go into the pit of hell. He didn't suffer with the devil laughing at him. He didn't pay the price of our sins in that way. He didn't suffer punishment in hell. This is an aberration that some, you know, Protestant preachers, quite frankly, they will preach, but it's not true. So that's the hell that's being referred to there, not the hell of the damned. Another email comes in from Patricia, listening on the Relevant Radio app. She says, regarding an unknown sinful habit. She says, I'm a cigarette smoker. Is this considered a sin? Very good question, Patricia. I would put it this way. It may be that because you're addicted to nicotine, you're addicted to smoking, it may be that in the moment when you light up, you know, that you're not intending to commit a sin. You don't even necessarily want to commit a sin if you're addicted to it and you're having a hard time quitting. So that individual act in itself is part of a bigger chain of sins along the way, and even starting in the first place, because the fifth commandment is thou shalt not kill, and that extends to things like what would harm your body, and smoking definitely will harm your body. So there is sin involved, but as you get down to the point where you light up right now, in terms of your own culpability in the moment, it may be greatly diminished. But I would suggest to you that recognizing that smoking, once you realize the damage that it does to your body and the danger that you put yourself in, danger of cancer, etc., that it's something that you should strive to overcome, strive to eliminate it. I know it's easier said than done, but I don't know that person because I have never been a smoker, so I don't know what it's like to go through that. But I know many people who have gone through it, and they're better for it by quitting smoking. So all other things being equal, I would advocate that smoking cigarettes can indeed be sinful, especially if you know that it's bad for your body and you do it anyway. Because there's no good reason to do it. There's no upside to smoking. I think in years gone by, people thought, well, it made you look cool or it made you look more adult. But we know so much more now about the effects of smoking and why you should avoid it. So my humble suggestion would be ask the Lord to deliver you from this craving, and he will. He may not do it all at once, and it doesn't mean that you wouldn't have to have recourse to things that will help you, like Nicorette gum or the patch or whatever else might be helpful to you. But I have met people who have said that part of their way of getting free of it was to ask the Lord for liberation from it, sometimes making a novena, sometimes special prayers or even a pilgrimage or something like that. But try it and see what happens. And then it'll be one less thing for you to have to worry about. Thank you for raising that issue. I think a lot of people listening right now may find themselves in that situation. How about Ivan now in Wisconsin Rapids? Good morning, Ivan.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a question. I have a ex-Protestant or ex-Catholic brother-in-law who is becoming Protestant. And he asked me the question of in heaven, that if it's such a perfect place, then why is it talk about there was wars in heaven where St. Michael cast down the...
Yeah.
Still there?
Yeah.
Cast down the devil and all that. So I was just curious, what's the answer for that?
Yeah, it's not difficult when you understand what that word is referring to. So when God created the angels, they were not in what we call the beatific vision. They didn't see God face to face the way they did in the case of the good angels once they passed their test. It seems that when God created them, and he created all the angels that exist all at once, and endowed all of them with the perfect awareness of who they are in relation to God and in relation to each other and the rest of creation, and they were given some kind of a choice. And that choice, we don't know exactly what it was, but we think that it was something that involved humility or pride, and that the angels, who chose self over God in some way, that their prideful choice, it instantaneously changed them from being good angels to being bad angels, fallen angels. And the good angels who passed the test, and it seems that that was the majority of them, they instantaneously entered into the beatific vision. So once they passed the test, suddenly now they're seeing God face to face. So in that sense, they went into heaven in the final sense, the beatific vision sense. But in the first phase, they were not yet in heaven. They were in heaven after a fashion with God, after a fashion, but they didn't see him face to face. There's no way they could have seen him face to face and then turned against him. So that word heaven in context is not referring to that final being in the direct presence of God. it's referring to the state that they were in just before or when they had that test. Some passed it, some failed it. Does that make sense?
Oh, a little bit.
Okay. Well, I'm glad I could be a little bit of help to you. Did you have a follow-up on that?
Huh?
Okay. I mean, we've got some problems with the phone line, but thanks. Appreciate it. Let's go to Teresa now in Berkeley Springs, West Virginia. Hi, Teresa.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi. I just have a little comment for the lady who called about praying for herself now while she's alive.
Yeah.
That's a good thing to do. But the purgatory lady, Susan Tassone or Tassoni, I'm not sure how you say it, in a few of her books, she mentions leaving instructions and money in your will to have masses said for you and also to have Gregorian masses said for yourself.
Yep.
So that's a way that she can, you know, besides praying for herself now, she can ensure that she's going to have prayers for her masses for herself after she's dead. Because I know a lot of people, even Catholics, they're like, what's purgatory? But anyway, I thought that'd be a good thing for her to know.
Yeah, in fact, I think I mentioned that or words to that effect yesterday or the day before, I forget which, about Gregorian masses and having them said for people, including yourself. So that's certainly, that's certainly a good idea. It wasn't exactly what she was talking about, but I see what you mean. It is another way to ensure that there are prayers said for you after you go.
Right.
Yeah. Well, good, Teresa. I appreciate that.
Sure.
Thank you.
Patrick, can you help me with this one?
I think so.
I don't understand. If I'm paying someone to pray for me, those prayers are meaningless. If I'm paying them, if they're only doing it because, you gave me money, I have an obligation, I'll pray for you. This is a job. That's not... There's got to be more to praying than that.
There is, yeah. So let me put it in context. So there are, let's say... let's use an example of a convent of cloistered religious sisters. So maybe there are 30 of them, and they're in their convent, and they don't come out. And what they do is they pray. They pray for you and me, and that's their apostolate, is prayer. A very important apostolate. Well, they still have to turn on the lights, and they still have to heat the house, and they need food, and the typical things that you need to get along. So what they do is, rather than making caskets or wine or coffee or jelly or popcorn and selling it to make money to keep themselves going, what they do is they say, we specialize in praying for people. And so if you wanted to make a donation of X dollars, and maybe you just decide what you want, we will add your name or the name of the person that you want to be prayed for. We'll add that person's name, and we will actively pray to the Lord every day for that person. So it's not that you're buying prayers, or it's not that the prayers are cheapened because, there's money involved, but because it's a way to show support for those sisters or the priests, for example, who are doing this, because that's the way that they survive is on the generosity of people who, they realize prayer is so important. I really want people praying for this intention. And since they're not making caskets or coffee or something else to support their life and their food, I'm going to send them a donation as a way to support that. Right. How does that sound to you? Does that make it
better? That makes way more sense. What I envisioned is, hey, Bob, my atheist friend, I'm about to die. Here's, $100. Pray for me.
Yeah.
Okay.
You're getting paid off.
Thanks for that $100. See ya.
Of course, the atheist friend's not going to pray for you, is he?
Yeah, right. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah, sure. And it's a good question. It's probably one that people listening might even have because it's, when we think about it, it could come across as crass, as if we are buying and selling sacred things, but we're not. So hopefully that explanation cleared it up a little bit. Thank you. Let's go now to an email from Mike listening in San Francisco. And he says, regarding the question of can a man get pregnant, he says, is it simply that if these non-binary advocates believe that when they define trans female to male as men, than a man can get pregnant. Is this logical? Thanks for your great work. Well, yes, I think that's exactly what it amounts to, Mike, that their whole shtick is that a man can become a woman and a woman can become a man. So it's predicated upon this false assumption that a woman who says that she's a man, a trans man, quote unquote, that she can get pregnant. So what they're saying is that she really is a man, therefore men can get pregnant. And obviously that's not true, because it is based upon an erroneous presupposition. So the presupposition itself is that a man or that a woman can become a man. Well, that's false. Doesn't really happen, even though they'll jump up and down and, you know, hoop and holler about that. It doesn't make it so. It doesn't make it real. So because the premise is erroneous, the conclusion is therefore also erroneous, which is that therefore a man can get pregnant. And you know, and thanks for the email, Mike. You know, another strange thing about this whole issue is that the whole worldview is predicated upon this notion that your gender or sex is assigned to you at birth. And that's not true either. It's not assigned to you. It's recognized. When you popped out of your mom, the doctor or the nurse held you up and said, oh, it's a boy. How can you tell? Well, you can tell. Oh, it's a girl. How do you know? Why did you assign that sex? Well, I'm not assigning anything. I'm just looking anatomically. You've got a girl or you've got a boy. It's called science. Maybe some of these people should look that up. Google. It's a great tool for that kind of thing.
Speaking of Google, I've looked this up before. Can a man get pregnant? And Google.
Oh, I know what Google's going to say.
They've changed their answer. So before it was, yes, a man can get pregnant. Now, this just changed.
Oh.
It says people who are born male and living as men can.
That describes me to a T. I was born male and I
living
live
as a man.
Man
cannot get pregnant. A transgender man or non-binary person may be able to. However, it is only possible for a person to be pregnant if they have a uterus. A uterus
Indeed,
is the
sir.
Womb, which is where the fetus develops.
Not just a uterus, but a birth canal. Because if you somehow could get pregnant or be pregnant, whatever, and there's no way for that baby to come out, you have a big problem.
I don't
May I wanna, say to you?
I don't even want to think about it, sir.
I mean, just... Yeah, we don't have to... I mean, you got a big problem. A big old problem. So you're right, Cyrus. That's interesting. I can't keep up with it. It's dizzying, the pace at which they have to scramble to shore things up and nip and tuck
and
change.
At least Google came back to a little bit towards reality.
That's true.
I guess.
Yes, that's true.
Oh, that's good.
I can't even do it. Let me hear her say it.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah. You don't want that on your karmic record.
Ooh, I don't want that on my karmic record.
No, I really don't.
No, you really don't. You don't want being pregnant without a birth canal on your karmic record. That's for sure.
Yeah,
that'll go down in the history. That'll go down in the history books. Email from Jim, listening on the Relevant Radio app, referring to Vice President Harris on abortion and faith, says, I heard yesterday that the vice president announced that anyone can be in favor of abortion without violating the tenets of his faith. Other than CNA and Fox Network, I haven't heard anything about this. Have any bishops or the Holy Father commented? Well, come on, Jim. The Catholic bishops of the United States have been ringing this bell for a long time, endlessly.
Come on, man.
No, really, they have.
Come on, man.
No, really, they have.
Come on, man.
No, really, they have.
Come on, man.
Seriously, they have.
Come on.
I mean
okay,
it.
Come on. Come on, man.
See, I'm playing chicken with you now. I want to see how far you go before you blink. I just found out. No, Well, okay, I don't mean to be flippant, Jim. What I mean, though, is that how come any bishops haven't commented? Do you mean that how come they haven't commented on what VP Harris had to say? If that's what you mean, I mean, if who knows what she's saying at any given moment. Do we have some commentary from our vice president, Cyrus, that we can play?
Do I have to?
Yeah, just because she says a lot of things. All the time she's saying things. Let's hear it.
Oh, give me 2 seconds.
Give me something.
Give me 2 seconds.
Words of wisdom from on high.
Oh,
I don't think people pay attention. I really don't think they pay attention.
Yeah. Oh, boy. I'm not finding it. I'm not finding them on the fly. I know.
All right.
Total fail.
All right. Well, okay. So, yeah, Jim, I think that's the thing. You can't keep up with all the stuff that's being said. And by the way, who cares what Vice President Harris says about what you can or cannot believe without violating the tenets of your faith? She's not in a position of authority to dictate that to people. So I don't know. Big yawn from me. But as far as the bishops are concerned, they've been, well, I'll put it this way. Most of the bishops in the United States have been very stalwart and upfront on this issue of abortion. And I'm glad of it. So thanks for that. 888-914-9149, break time. And we'll come back with more of the show right after this. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
We must together work together to see where we are, where we are headed, where we are going, and our vision for where we should be, but also see it as a moment, yes, to together address the challenges and to work on the opportunities.
Okay. I'm not sure what that means.
Standing here on the northern flank, on the eastern flank, talking about what we have in terms of the eastern flank and our NATO allies, and what is at stake at this very moment.
Oh.
Is that what you're looking for?
It sounds momentous. It sounds like she's building up to something. Do you have any more?
You want more?
Can you take any more?
I don't think anybody
I'm just waiting. Wants more. I'm waiting for the big punchline. I'm waiting for the big reveal.
There's the punchline. Yeah.
President Biden has COVID. And I hope, I really do. I'm sincere. I really do hope that he recovers fully and regains his health. But politics being what it is, people, you know. We just heard on the news thing with our very own Glenn Leverance in the last break or two that apparently his poll numbers are so low, they need a telescope to see them now.
Okay.
Really? So I'm wondering. I don't know. I really do hope, and I mean this sincerely. I know I've said it a few times, but I mean it. I really am sincere. I hope he does get over COVID swiftly and no lasting problems. But politics is like a shark tank. And when one of the sharks isn't doing so well, you know, there's always another shark behind trying to take that shark's place. So maybe another reason to pray for him. Well, let's see. I've got an email here from Anonymous, listening in Wisconsin Rapids, who says, "Hey, Patrick, I have a question on the fruitfulness of the sacraments. As far as I understand, every sacrament has three qualities, fruitfulness, validity, and licitness." It's actually laceity, but no big deal. If it were to come to pass that a pope would no longer allow the Latin Mass to be said, I assume that the form would be valid but illicit, right? Would it affect the fruitfulness of the sacrament? The second part of my question is whether a sacrament's fruitfulness is dependent upon both the internal disposition of the recipient of the sacrament and the sacrament itself. Thank you for all you do. You have helped me grow in my faith and emboldened me to speak the truth to those I encounter. Well, thank you, Anonymous. So let's look at this. You're correct that the sacrament has three dimensions, if we want to use that term, or three aspects of the sacrament. One is the validity. Is it really a sacrament? Did it really happen? And that would depend upon the valid form and the matter and the intention. The second aspect would be the liceity. You said licitness. That works too. That means the lawfulness. The sacrament could be celebrated validly but unlawfully. So let's say there's a renegade Catholic priest who just decides, I'm out of here. I'm not going to do this anymore. But he still wants to be a kind of priest doing rent-a-priest stuff and doing weddings and whatnot. So he still can validly celebrate the Holy Eucharist, but it would be illicit for him to do so because of his status as a sacerdotus vagabondus, as they say in Latin, a vagabond priest, you know, priest on the run. He's not under his bishop, etc. So it could be valid, but it would be illicit. And then the third category or aspect would be the spiritual fruitfulness of it. What is the benefit to the soul of the person receiving the sacrament? So with those things in mind, let's say that it came to pass that a given pope were to say, henceforth, there will be no more masses allowed in Latin, meaning in this hypothetical scenario, that it would be illicit for a priest to celebrate the traditional Latin Mass. So let's just say that, let's say that happened. Well, in terms of the law of the church, it is true. It would become illicit from a legal standpoint for a priest to celebrate the traditional Latin Mass. Now, the validity of the Mass would not be affected thereby. It would still be a valid Mass. And if the person receiving Holy Communion, and I presume that's what you're referring to, the person receiving Holy Communion in this validly but illicitly celebrated Mass, would that be spiritually fruitful for that person? I think the answer must devolve, it must come down to the issue of, is the person, does the person receiving know that this is illicit, even though he disagrees with this decree from this hypothetical pope, and he thinks this is really a bad idea, you shouldn't do this, it's kind of contrary to everything that we know from 2,000 years of Catholic understanding of the Mass, and yet you've made it illicit, you've made it illegal. I think the spiritual fruitfulness would depend upon, is this person guilty of a sin of disobedience against the Pope? And I think you can make a case that, objectively speaking, yes, because the Pope does have an authority, even if he misuses that authority. Here again, we're speaking hypothetically. So a Pope can misuse his authority and answer to God for it and be dead wrong in a decision that he makes in terms of the governance of the church. But you still, as long as he's not telling you to commit a sin, like, hey, everybody, you know, starting tomorrow at noon, you have to commit adultery at least once a month. You can ignore that. It's outlandish, obviously, but you can ignore that because you don't have any obligation to obey anybody who's saying to you, you've got to commit a sin, even if that person happens to be the Pope. So in this case, to use your hypothetical, it seems to me that the spiritual fruitfulness for the person receiving an illicitly communion from an illicitly celebrated Mass, which happens to be a beautiful Mass, but it's been made illegal by that hypothetical Pope. If you in your heart are saying, well, I know the Pope has the authority to do this, but who cares? I'm going to receive this anyway. I'd have to draw a question mark there, because that would involve a Catholic intentionally, knowingly flouting the legitimate authority of the Pope, even if the decision that he made is terribly, terribly wrong. Now, the other side of the coin would be if the person receiving Holy Communion maybe was unaware of this or had not thought it through, or just maybe a simple person who just didn't understand the bigger picture, but in good faith goes to Mass, this is Jesus, I want to receive Holy Communion, would it be spiritually fruitful? I think absolutely it would, because there is no intention there to do something that at some level you know is itself sinful. So it's an interesting and terrifying hypothetical question that you ask. And let's hope it always remains hypothetical and nothing more. Thank you. 888-914-9149. How about Cindy now in Phoenix? Good morning, Cindy.
Good morning, Patrick. You were talking about men having babies. And every time I've been hearing that, I've been remembering a movie from a long time ago. I don't know if you know it, but Arnold Schwarzenegger was pregnant.
Well, you know that was a movie. I do. I don't know that I saw it, but you know that was just a movie.
Yeah, well, I know. Okay. But the thoughts that came to my mind was, you know, when he went into labor was, how was he going to deliver? And then on top of that was, what was causing his labor?
Yeah.
So I was just, I know it was just a movie, but I just thought it funny.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's an absurd, that's what, I don't remember. Cyrus, do you remember what that movie was? I remember.
Junior, 1994.
Junior. Wow. I know what I was doing when you saw that movie.
Oh, what was that, Patrick?
I was probably praying the rosary. I don't know. I don't think I ever saw it. But I think I saw the movie poster where he's out to hear pregnant, which is kind of weird looking.
Yes, it was. Another thing, you need to fill young Thomas in on who Arnie Schwarzenegger is.
Does young Thomas not know who Arnold Schwarzenegger
Thomas.
Is?
Wait, I'll talk to him, Patrick.
Oh, Thomas.
He hadn't seen Back to the Future before he started working here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he's got a lot to learn. But yeah, he came to the right place. We're bombarding him with information, Cindy. Even
I promise to help him.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I do remember vaguely that movie, but I'm kind of glad I never saw it. But you're right. Questions like, well, how's that baby going to get out, etc. Mysteries of the ages. Thank you. Let us go to Yesenia now in San Diego. Hi, Yesenia.
Hi, good morning, Patrick. How are you?
Doing well, thank you. Happy to talk to you.
I'm happy to talk to you, too. Thank you so much. I have a question. I go to Mass on Sundays, and okay. I see our priest with the deacon always present, of course, helping him out. I just wanted to know the role of the deacon. The deacon at our church says a homily, and that kind of breaks my heart that the father gives the deacon a blessing, and the deacon then, you know, goes ahead and says the homily. Why does the deacon say the homily and not the priest?
Okay. Well, don't let it break your heart. Let your heart not be troubled, because that is one of the roles that the deacon is called to fulfill, not on a regular or frequent basis necessarily. It's at the permission of the pastor. But he does have that duty as part of his ministry to, among other things at Mass, to assist at the altar. So he helps to prepare the gifts. You probably see the deacon, you know, preparing the water and the wine and the chalice and placing the sacred vessels on the altar. He has that role. That's part of what he does liturgically. He also is there to assist the priest in other ways. And that would also include when the priest gives permission, the pastor typically, then the deacon can not only proclaim the gospel, but also he can preach a sermon. So there's no reason for your heart to be broken, because the deacon is doing what deacons are supposed to do at Mass.
Okay. And is there a reason why the priests nowadays are not, I mean, I don't know if it's, how would I say it, performing their duties? I mean, it seems mm-hmm. to me sometimes that they just, they feel comfortable now that they have enough help, like the deacons, the ministers helping them all the time,
yeah.
That even that they sit down to not give the Holy Communion. I mean, again, it seems to me like the priests are just sitting back and not doing their job.
Well, if I had to guess, I'm going to go out on a limb, Yesenia, and guess that you haven't seen this happen a lot or with a lot of different priests, but I don't doubt that you've seen it. And maybe there's a priest who did sit down at Holy Communion and let the deacon and the lay ministers of Holy Communion distribute communion. So as a simple rule of thumb, the priest, let's just talk about the communion issue. The priest is the ordinary minister of the Holy Eucharist. Now, deacons are also counted in that category. Lay people are not. Lay people are extraordinary. And so if a priest is there and he's in good health, let's say he doesn't have a bad back or he doesn't have vertigo, so he's worried about falling over or some other problem that might prevent him from doing so, he should distribute Holy Communion because he is at the altar. He is in the sanctuary also as an alter Christus, that Latin phrase, which means another Christ, or he's in persona Christi. He's acting in the person of Christ. And Christ, the good shepherd, feeds his sheep. He doesn't sit back and say to his assistants, say, you know, I'm just going to take a lunch break over here. Why don't you guys just feed the sheep? I'm going to kick back over here with a good book. So the symbolism is very important. And when the priest is feeding the flock in the form of distributing Holy Communion, he's fulfilling, and you might say even heightening, that symbolism of him as Christ, the good shepherd. There can be situations where the priest is ill, or he may have some other reason that's legitimate that he's not able to distribute Holy Communion. But outside of those situations, he should. That's something that, you know, the bishop would ordinarily police or govern if it should get to that point. But as far as the deacons themselves are concerned, I think what you're seeing is just deacons doing what deacons are authorized to do. And if there's a priest at your parish who feels as though the deacon is a better preacher than he is, maybe that's why the deacon preaches more often than he does. Yeah, that's nothing wrong with that. But ordinarily, a deacon is going to preach infrequently, maybe once a month, perhaps sometimes more. But that seems to be the custom that I've noticed around the country. I hope that's helpful, Yesenia. Thank you. Appreciate that. We'll go now to Chris listening in Wisconsin. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Patrick. Yes. My question is, during the liturgy of the Eucharist, at what moment does the consecration take place?
Well, it's one liturgical action, so keep in mind that it's the church looks at this as from the start of what's called the epiclesis. Sometimes people will call it the epiclesis. That's where the priest extends his hands over the gifts on the altar with his palms facing down. And he invokes the Holy Spirit to come down upon these gifts and make them holy, etc. The action, this liturgical action of the consecration is understood to begin then. But the key in terms of the actual consecration is when the priest says the words of consecration, and specifically, "This is my body." And in the case of the chalice, "This is my blood." Now, there's more that's said. The words of institution that Jesus said are longer than that. But the church identifies those specific words and when they are spoken with the intention of consecrating them and, of course, valid matter. It's at that point, if you want to be really specific, that the church says that the consecration has taken place. And it's for this reason, by the way, beginning, as I recall, probably about the year 1200 in Paris, where the custom arose that at that point of the Mass, that's when the priest would elevate the host, as you see it done on Sundays. The priest would raise the host high. Prior to that, it really was never done. It wasn't a custom for priests to elevate the host. And the reason that they did so, and the reason that there were bells that would ring at that time, and for example, with the consecration of the chalice, and even before that with the epiclesis, was because the priests and the people in the traditional Mass are facing God together. They're all facing the same way, which is beautiful and good, if you ask me. And so because the people in the congregation wouldn't be able to see, being the priest, when he's celebrating a low Mass, his voice is inaudible. So they couldn't hear him say the words of consecration. So when the bells would ring, then they would know. And when the priest would elevate the host, they would know, okay, Jesus is now here. So that custom of elevating the host at that point where he says, "This is my body, which will be given up for you." And then he holds the host up so people can adore the Lord in the host. That's where that custom came from. Because it's at that moment then that the church says the real presence is now here. Before that, this is a piece of bread. Now, Jesus is here.
Okay, thank you.
You are most welcome. Thank you. Isn't it interesting, the questions we get here on the Patrick Madrid Show? I am grateful for all of you wonderful listeners and all of you wonderful questions. I'm going to be back with the rest of the show right after this. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
All right. Looking at the time, we've got about 12 minutes to go. Let's go to Regan now in Berkeley, West Virginia. Regan or Reagan, am I saying it right?
Yes.
Okay, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
I am well, thank you.
Okay, so I just wanted to get your opinion on living together but not being married.
Okay.
So I live with my boyfriend and I just became Catholic about a year ago.
Wonderful.
And I'm 23, so I'm okay. I'm still pretty young.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I know it's a sin, but I don't want to force him to marry me. Right. So I just want to, I guess, see your opinion about that.
Yeah, well, you know, I'll begin by saying that my opinion ultimately is irrelevant, but it's more importantly, what does God say about it? What does the church say about it? And this would be in the category of what's called fornication. And that's where a man and a woman either live together or at the very least they're engaging in sexual activity, but they're not married. And the reason that's a sin is because sexual activity, sexual intercourse, as God created it for our enjoyment and for procreation, its proper context is within marriage, because it's within marriage then that you have a commitment to your husband and he has a commitment to you. So there's stability, there's mutual commitment, there's protection for babies who might be born. You're not going to be left in the lurch. You know, if you as the woman got pregnant and then he finds another person he likes better and he leaves you and now you've got a child and nobody to help you make your way through life. So the plan, as God designed it, was that the man and the woman would join together in marriage, which is a lifelong commitment, so that you have the ingredients necessary not only for a happy and stable marriage, but also a happy and stable home in which children can flourish and move out into the world. So when we make use of the pleasure of sexual intercourse without the responsibility that comes with marriage and the commitment that comes with marriage, that's the essence of the sin, because it's making use of a good thing, but you're not entitled to that good thing. It's not proper to you to do that. But if you were married, then it would be proper to you. You would be entitled to it. And it's actually something God encourages married couples to enjoy, because it's part of it's one of the blessings of marriage. So I don't want to say it's bad because I say it's bad, but it's bad because it is a disruption or a distortion of what God intends for you as a woman and your husband eventually as a man. Now, I could say a lot more, but does that at least give you some more insight into it?
Yes, thank you.
The thing to remember is that everybody is given sexual identity by God as male or female, and maybe with some exceptions for people who just have super low libido for whatever reason. Almost everybody, you know, when you're an adult anyway, you have strong sexual attraction, strong sexual appetites. But we can see just by looking around that if everybody were to act upon their sexual appetites and proclivities without regard to things like, oh, well, that's not my wife or that's not your husband, we would have chaos and murder, you know, people being jealous, and there would be all kinds of terrible things that would accrue if we all just lived out our sexual appetites however we wanted to. It would be mayhem, to say it lightly. And that is kind of a practical way of looking at why God has enshrined sex and marriage this way as a way to protect it. This is a very powerful power that we have. And I always like to think of it, well, I shouldn't say like to, but I do think of it as kind of akin to nuclear energy, you know, like a nuclear power plant. Extremely powerful. And it can provide electricity for everyone in the country. It could also destroy cities if it gets out of control. So in the same way, our sexual powers are so powerful that we have to be very careful how we make use of them so that we don't wind up destroying ourselves and other people, which very often happens when people live that way. Rather, it's like a contained environment, marriage is, like a nuclear reactor. It's contained. And the power is used for a good purpose. And it's never allowed to get out of control and have a meltdown and a chain reaction, because that's where people wind up dying. So I know I'm using analogies, but sometimes those are helpful in thinking about why God says that sex is intended for marriage for these reasons, among others. What do you think?
That makes a lot of sense. Thank you.
You're welcome. Can I offer you a fatherly bit of suggestion? Because you're the age of my youngest daughter. So,
yes, go ahead.
If you don't mind. What I would say to you is what I would say to her, and that is that the situation you're in right now puts you at a really severe disadvantage in that you are being used. Now, the guy you're with might be a great guy, and maybe he doesn't even realize what's going on, but you are being used for his pleasure, and maybe you get some pleasure out of it too, but there's no commitment to you. There's no promise to death do us part that he's going to take care of you and raise any children that he might have with you. I don't know whether or not contraception is involved. Let's assume that it is. You don't have to tell me. But even there now, you've got really what amounts to a lie, because the sexual act is the act of mutual self-giving within marriage, where the husband and the wife are saying to each other, I'm giving myself totally to you. And this bodily action is a way of expressing that. Total self-giving. But in fact, it's not really what's happening when an unmarried man and woman are living together or having sexual intercourse, even if they're not living together, because with their bodies, what they're saying is, I'm just enjoying you for a time, and I may get tired of you and move on. But marriage is not that. Marriage is this stable environment, the natural habitat for sexual activity, because within this now stable, permanent union, the two of you really are giving yourselves to each other and everything that goes with that, including maybe there will be a baby that will come from this. And our love between the two of us and the commitment between the two of us is now paying dividends, so to speak, in the form of another life that God brings into existence as the fruit of our married love. So I would just strongly encourage you to not allow yourself to be in this situation. Even if you're in love with this man, set your boundaries and say, if you really love me, then marry me. And if you're not willing to marry me, you're certainly not worthy of having me in the way that you are right now. You're better than that. And you're worth far more than that. So I would draw that line and discontinue this arrangement until and unless he's willing to marry you, if you think he's the right one. And if he's not the right one, then all the more reason to bring it to a screeching halt, because you're wasting your time when your husband-to-be is out there somewhere. If you know that this guy is not that guy, then just end it immediately, because it's not good for you. That's what I'd say to my daughter.
Okay, thank you. Yes, thank you. You've given me a lot to think about and talking points that I can say to him, because he's also Catholic.
Okay.
So, yes, I appreciate all your words.
You're welcome. And I'm not trying to tear him down. I don't know anything about him. He may be really a great guy, and he might be the perfect guy to get married to. Only you can make those decisions. But those are things you have to take into account. But at the very least, if you were to say, you know what, we're not doing this anymore because it's a sin, and I want to put God first, and I want you to put God first, you're saying to him, that'll be another test. If he says, well, yeah, but I really would rather do this, then that tells you a lot about his character. So there's some interesting.
He is a great guy. I bet he is. Like you said about the whole commitment. I think that's the thing. That's really blocking going forward.
Has he said anything about that? Has he indicated whether he wants to get married?
Yeah, I think he has. He has said it's just not the right timing, he says, because he's younger than me. So I think it has a little bit to do with that.
Maybe, but in the meantime, though, he, as the old saying goes, have your cake and eat it too. And Jesus said, don't do that. So now that you're Catholic, one beautiful thing is that you've got the ability to go to confession and to say, I'm sorry, Lord, that I've been doing this. I'm not going to do it again. And then you get yourself back on track spiritually. And that's really where you need to be if you're going to make some of these momentous decisions. You know, you want to be right with God and knowing that you're heading in the right direction. You know.
Okay, yes, thank you. You've given me a lot to think about, like I said, and I appreciate everything that you've said.
You're welcome, Reagan. You're welcome. And one thought before I go, I have to take a 21-hour break now, but I would encourage you to get a book by Steve Wood. It's called The ABCs of Finding a Good Husband. You can look it up online. His website is dads.org. You'll find it there too. But The ABCs of Finding a Good Husband. I would read that book as you make these decisions. Thank you, and God bless you. I will be back with you again tomorrow. Same Pat time, same Pat channel. In the meantime, please pray for me, and I will pray for you. God bless you.